The Heaven Field, a novel by I.G. Hume, read by the author. Episode 26, Contact.
"What in hell just happened?"
shouted Commander James furiously, gazing down from the control room window. Far below, a bright light shone from the array chamber hall, and a tower of dust billowed up towards them.
"Security, what is your status?"
he yelled into the intercom.
Sir, we're just trying to find out, sir,"
came a distorted cry over James's earpiece.
"The target is down. I repeat, he is down,"
came the yell again.
"What?"
cried James.
"I expressly gave the order that he was no longer a threat."
"It seems that some of the security team did not receive the order to stand down, sir. We're trying to find out more now." James's face was ashen. "What was that explosion? Do you have Dr. Palmer and Sullivan? Are they safe?" he called anxiously.
Negative, sir. We have four persons from the field, but there's some disturbance in the area around the chamber. We can't get near it yet."
There was a sound of howling wind screaming over the intercom.
"Just find Palmer and Sullivan," shouted James.
"Yes, sir. Oh, sir, I have the four others from the field. They are claiming to be from the opposing forces. They're demanding to talk with you urgently."
"I'm coming down," said James gravely.
"Burns, with me," he snapped as he made for the lifts.
"Dr. Grayson, Commander James, sir,"
called one of the technicians as James stormed across the room.
"What is it?"
cursed James. "Make it quick."
"Well, it's the array, sir,"
said the technician nervously, as Jim Grayson and Commander James both loomed over her.
"I'm still reading a standing point in the chamber."
"What do you mean?"
asked Grayson urgently. "You can't be reading it right."
"We'll take a look."
The young woman punched up a set of readings on the main monitor wall.
"The gauges must be damaged," muttered Grayson.
"We can't be reading it right."
"Everything checks out, sir," called another technician.
"According to this, the array's still operating at full capacity."
"That can't be," shouted James sternly. "Shut it down."
"I'm trying, sir. There's no response. All the generators are offline. It's as if it's running itself."
"God damn it," cursed James.
"You, turn that thing off immediately. I'm going down to the hall."
James barked his command at Jim Grayson, then turned and strode out of the room.
"But, sir, it's as if the ray is resonating at standing point,"
stammered Grayson, desperately punching away at a keyboard.
"It could tear the whole array apart. Shouldn't we evacuate?"
But James was already heading for the lift doors, on his way down to the array hall. Gary Starling sat under the brooding shadow of the dark cliff. His eyes darted fearfully upwards as a small clatter of pebbles fell noisily to the rocky floor nearby. He caught movement, and noted the suited figure of a British soldier moving into cover high up the cliff wall. All along the cliff tops he could see similar figures taking up defensive positions.
"What do you think?"
came an anxious question from the man at his side. Starling looked back out over the long flat plain. He wasn't enjoying his new promotion. He had somehow found himself volunteering for the role of technical advisor, and within half an hour he'd been back in the field, trying to coordinate an evacuation. He looked back down at his hastily scribbled calculations and sighed.
"Even if we discard everything, equipment, weapons, we'll still only get half of the troops back before the enemy hits us. We might get all of our guys and the Americans, but those ones..."
He waved a hand over to where Vladich's forces were reorganizing their positions. The ground shook with the rumble of tanks and transports.
"Those guys wouldn't have a hope. We just can't operate the array fast enough to bring everyone back. I'm sorry."
He looked up guiltily at the commander of the British security troops and shrugged apologetically.
"If we could evacuate some of the troops using the field ships and get them past the army and back to the American entry points, then we could have a chance. But we couldn't afford to lose more than another three ships. After that, there will be no way."
Starling let out a long sigh.
"And all that's assuming that we can get anyone out through our doorway at all."
The officer looked up in surprise.
"What do you mean?"
he asked, glancing out towards the brooding horizon.
"Well, all our readings that we've taken here," began Starling. "Something weird is going on. It's as if the doorway's still in its open state.
after the last group went through, we're still reading a standing point field. I think we should wait till we get some word from Control that it's safe. I've never seen anything like it before. Do you think those things, do you think they could get through? Back to Control, muttered the commander, as he surveyed the dark horizon once more through his binoculars. I really don't know, whispered Starling. But all my readings say the doorway is open. I really wouldn't like to take the chance. That's what I thought, sighed the officer. I'll pass on your report to Major Hawking. You better get back to the doorway before they hit us. The first chance you hear that it's safe, get yourself back home. Starling nodded forlornly, and trudged heavily off in the direction of the doorway. The officer went back to surveying the plains through his binoculars. Starling looked down the slope to the bottom of the shallow valley, where the American and Vladich's forces were regrouping. They were pulling back towards the rocky outcrop and the site of the doorway, digging in and taking up defensive positions. Engines throbbed and turbines whined as the field ships rose unsteadily into the air on clouds of red dust. The flames from their exhausts lit up the rapidly darkening sky, and the glow of the fires in the distance glinted off the dull metal vehicles. As far as the eye could see, a storm of fire approached. The mountains in the distance were obscured by a towering wall of red dust and black smoke, and already the ground shook with their approach. The army was still too distant to make out individual creatures, even with binoculars, but the dark line of their marching forces was like some apocalyptic vision of Armageddon. A tumbling wall of flames as far as the eye could see, poised, ready to engulf their pitiful defences. Starling stopped and stared again at the approaching onslaught, then back at the 60 or so British security men defending the doorway. The Americans were around 150 strong. Vladich's men were slightly greater in numbers. The terrible army would hit them in about an hour if it kept up its course. He cursed quietly to himself, then turned and trudged back towards the commanding officer. You know, I think I'd be more help here, he muttered, still staring out over the plains. The officer gave him a grim smile of thanks. If you're sure, he said quietly. We could do with all the help we can get. See the sergeant. He'll show you how to use a weapon. Starling trudged off again, feeling sick to his stomach.
Okay, Private, just calm down. Now where's your commanding officer?
I don't know, sir. I think he's dead. We engaged them up on the ridge, but they're everywhere. There's too many of them, we...
It's all right. We're gonna get you out of there. Now, what are your coordinates?
I don't know, sir. Everything shot up pretty bad. We tried to take off, but my pilot got hit. I think... Oh, shit! They're on the hull! They're on that!
Do you read me? I repeat, do you hear me? Let us have your coordinates. We'll send a team to get you out of there. Do you copy? Over.
The communications officer tossed the radio handset down in frustration. The control room had fallen silent, as all ears listened to the sound of screams and gunfire over the radio speaker.
Turn that goddamn thing off, snapped Boynes. I told you it was a waste of resources, hissed Vladich, pacing the bustling room in agitation.
The personnel had quickly gone back to their tasks of plotting charts and coordinating troop movements.
We must defend our positions here. That was a foolish act of misguided. Don't tell me how to run my operations, snapped Boynes defensively. We need to ascertain their strengths, make probing attacks.
And what do you know now that you didn't before?
That we face an unstoppable force of impossible odds? It shouldn't take the loss of those men to tell us that much.
Colonel Boynes, sir, came an urgent shout.
The Herald, sir.
Boynes gave Vladich another furious stare, then turned back to his orderly.
Well, what is it? He muttered, still casting angry glances at Vladich, who continued his agitated pacing.
The uneasy alliance was showing signs of strain. The three forces of Vladich's men, the British and the Americans, shared a joint control centre aboard Colonel Boynes's ship, the Divinity, which was concealed in a clear area at the base of the cliffs, only yards from the doorway. Vladich had protested from the start at Boynes's plan to send out a series of probing attacks to slow down the onset of the creeps, as Boynes had irreverently named the oncoming army. He had hoped to buy some more time for the evacuation of troops through the British entry point,
Now the colonel was reluctantly having to admit he had underestimated the situation. His squads had been overrun within minutes, and long-range scans had reported the loss of all three of his precious field ships, a fifth of his flying forces destroyed. Grudgingly, he was having to face the fact that he would have to rely on the cooperation of Laditch and his men. He cursed himself again in quiet frustration, and turned back to his orderly. "What did you say?" he muttered in disbelief, unable to take in the man's words.
"The Herald, sir."
"She's in visual range." "Put it up on screen," snapped Boynes, sitting down heavily in his chair. The wall panel sprang into life, and a dusty picture of the dark horizon appeared.
"The Herald? Is she one of yours?"
asked Major Hawking of the British contingent. He sat uneasily next to the empty seat reserved for Vladich.
"She's our flagship," muttered Boynes, half to himself. "She disappeared when that angel creature turned up."
Boynes leaned forward to get a closer view of the screen. The picture was grainy and crackled with bursts of static, but Boynes could make out the ungainly lines of the massive field ship, lightning and flames reflecting off its dull metal panels. It hung in the air as if its impossible bulk defied gravity, moving forwards ever so slowly at the head of the approaching army. Endless ranks of unearthly shaped creatures stretched out from behind the ship, following its course as if it were a standard bearer. Flames and smoke rose up from behind the mass of creatures, crowning the army in a sickly golden glow. Boynes stared open-mouthed as he tried to make out individual creatures, but they were still too distant to define.
"What the hell's going on, Spears?"
he whispered to himself in disbelief. "Hail them," he ordered wearily.
"We're getting no response from the Herald, sir," called the communications officer.
Boynes stared desperately back at the monitor screen, the vast advancing army with Spears' ship at its head.
"Just what's going on?"
he sighed again.
"Sir, we are receiving a transmission. It's Colonel Spears, sir."
Grace looked around in panic and confusion. The hands of the security guard who held her went limp, and the man fell heavily to the floor, a thick layer of red dust already forming over his body. He gave a short grunt, then lay still, his eyes wide open in terror. As Grace moved closer, the man's body gave a sudden convulsion, his chest heaving violently. With a vicious, tearing sound, the soldier's torso split open to reveal a heaving mass of bright red grubs scuttling about in the dead man's chest cavity. Grace cried out and jumped backwards, frantically staring about at her surroundings. She was somehow back in the field, sat on the bare rock of the doorway next to Thomas, who swayed silently on his knees. Two security guards lay a couple of yards away. They had died the instant they came into contact with the hostile atmosphere. There was no sign of Alex's body. Thomas gasped in terror, his hands on the dusty rock in front of him, his eyes wide with fear. He heard Grace cry out next to him, but he couldn't respond. His attention was held by a crack in the dry earth. Deep within the small fissure, Thomas spied the flower he had seen during his first visit to the field. The beauty of its exquisite white petals held him enraptured, and he realized he was grinning wildly to himself. As he watched, before his eyes the plant began to grow, shoots unfurling, new leaves and petals opening.
"It's beautiful,"
he whispered to himself, spellbound. His face pulled closer and closer to the ground as he witnessed a flower spread throughout the cracks in the rock and burst out into bloom.
"Thomas!" yelled Grace in alarm.
She sat with her back to the young man, gazing at the body of the soldier who had shot Alex. He lay on his side in an attitude of agony, his face pressed against the red rock. He was obviously dead, yet Grace could see his body moving slowly up and down. As she stared, dark shadows appeared around the corpse, slithering things which seemed to evade the light, writhing around in shadows of their own making. The eel-like creatures poured out from under the grisly corpse, encircling and entwining it, until it was consumed by a heaving mass of black shadow. Yet more creatures were appearing. Some strayed to the other dead soldier, but some started towards Grace and Thomas.
"Thomas!"
she yelled again in terror, jumping to her feet as the creatures swarmed towards them. She looked down, but Thomas was unmoved, still crouched down with his head against the rock.
"Come on!"
she shouted, and grabbed him by the shoulder. The creatures were only a few feet away. As she pulled him up, she thought he heard him mutter,
It's beautiful.
There was a sudden, noiseless explosion of light, and Grace was blinded by a flash of green light spreading out in all directions from them. She helped Thomas slowly to his feet and looked at him open-mouthed. He returned her look of astonishment, gazing about at the new scene. Gone were the dead soldiers and the eel-like creatures, although if he squinted, Thomas thought he could make out the shadows of where they had been. But now, instead of rough rock and bare red earth, the valley was once more carpeted with bright, lush grass, dotted with exquisite white flowers. Gary Starling trudged back along the narrow path at the base of the cliff. The roar of the storm could be heard as it approached, slowly eating up the plain, engulfing the flat rocks in smoke and flames. He hefted his heavy gun miserably as he walked back towards the position he had been assigned near the doorway. He was cursing his mood for volunteering to stay behind. His colleagues were all waiting for confirmation from Array Control that the doorway was operating correctly. They would probably all be safe back in the real world in a few minutes.
"What were you thinking?" he muttered to himself unhappily. "You're too old and fat to be a hero. Just keep your mouth shut next time."
He stopped at the top of a gentle slope, which led down to the area where the doorway was located. He nodded to the group of soldiers he was to join. They all muttered nervous greetings and turned anxiously back towards the plain. Starling peered down towards the doorway, an area of rock he had become acutely familiar with. He thought back to his first trips through, when they'd still called it the Heaven Field. He tried to picture the beauty of the lush grass and the strange, exquisite light glimmering off crystal veins in the rocks. Now the area looked like a skewed vision from the First World War. All about the plateau, figures scurried busily to and fro, digging networks of trenches or piling up defences. Already the field ships were landing on the clifftops, and the first tanks and tracked vehicles were being waved into place as they were dug in and camouflaged. Starling knew that the forces would have to hold out for at least a couple of hours while the array worked at full stretch to evacuate them little by little. And that was assuming they weren't delayed any longer by the strange readings of the doorway. He looked down and spied the three orange environment suits of his colleagues all huddled around the doorway, busily taking readings and making calculations as to why and how it could be stuck in its open state. Starling prayed that Grace and the others had made it back safely, and wondered what could have caused it to stay open. It was as if it were resonating at standing point. He looked down at the heavy rifle he held in his gloved hands. A moment of incredulity ran through him, as if he had suddenly awoken from a spell. He gazed back towards his colleagues in disbelief. One of them had spotted his orange suit up on the ridge and was waving towards him. He realized he had no explanation as to why he should have discarded his scientific work around the doorway in order to volunteer to carry a rifle. He was the head of the research team. He would be so much more use with his colleagues than wielding a gun he had only used on one previous occasion.
I've made a mistake, he stuttered quietly to himself, his head reeling in confusion, and set off back towards his colleagues, trying desperately to understand what could have made him act so out of character.
A shrill scream cut the air above him, and he was flung to the ground by a blast of wind. He looked up in terrible realization as a red whirlwind of dust sped over his head. He shook uncontrollably as he recognized that inhuman cry of primordial hate.
"No, get away," he croaked
as he looked towards the doorway, where soldiers crouched in panic or lay flattened against the rock by the wind.
"Get away from there,"
he shouted in a desperate warning, his voice getting louder as he stumbled to his knees and then to his feet. He saw his colleagues huddled around the white stones of the doorway as the red dust hovered above them, whipping at their suits.
"Get away from it!"
screamed Starling at the top of his voice, his lungs bursting as he began to run down the rocky path towards them. The three scientists studied the cloud in confusion, unsure of what they were witnessing. Slowly the dust settled over them.
"No! It's one of them! It's one of the creatures!"
yelled Starling in panic as he stumbled on. The soldiers around the area stood up cautiously, looking at Starling in alarm. Then suddenly the dust storm evaporated, and Starling fell to his knees in horror. The bodies of his three colleagues lay about the periphery of the doorway, slumped in attitudes of terror. The bones snapped like twigs, and standing over them, triumphant, was a beast of horrifying familiarity to Starling. It was the creature which had invaded his nightmares every night since that ill-fated expedition, with Saul Davison, Stuart Nix, Dan O'Keefe, and of course, Patty. With an ear-splitting shriek, the creature spread its enormous wings out behind it and leapt into the circle of stones. A blistering volley of shots erupted from the terrified soldiers all about, but they were too late. The creature had disappeared through the doorway. Commander James punched furiously at the call button, but the lift doors remained firmly closed.
Sir,
came a hesitant voice from behind.
What? Yelled James in frustration, still relentlessly pressing the button.
The lift, sir, replied the nervous technician. They don't operate when the array's online. It's a safety protocol.
Commander James turned angrily and stormed off to the edge of the safety railing, peering out over the vast array towers, down the 100-foot drop to the array chamber. He raised a derisive eyebrow. I thought the array was offline, he hissed icily.
Well, technically yes, but the safety protocols, they're triggered upon reading standing point in the array, which it seems we still somehow...
Show me the stairs, muttered James with a sigh. Soon he was following the nervous technician down flight upon flight of metal steps, a seemingly endless journey, whilst the array hall below seemed to get no nearer. After some 5 minutes of descending, James stopped to catch his breath, leaning heavily on the safety rail. Dave Burns stood impassively at his shoulder. The squat man hadn't even broken into a sweat. As James stood gasping, he surveyed the figures scurrying about in the confusion of the array hall. A towering plume of red dust billowed up from the chamber, casting a dark shadow over the vast open space. The top of the cloud was almost on a level with James's vantage point, slowly spiralling upwards like some lazy cyclone. Its base was mostly obscured, but he could see a bright light shining out from its centre. Technicians worked frantically around the edges of the storm, attempting to shut down the array as it throbbed and groaned at its highest capacity. James watched as a technician, bent double in her wildly flapping white coat, darted across the hall as she tried to gain access to the emergency shut-off controls. He looked on in horror as the woman strayed too near the centre of the cloud. With terrible slowness, the strength of the gale sucked her off balance, and she lost her footing, grabbing out desperately for purchase, but finding none. The storm dragged her inexorably in towards the light, and she slid screaming into the dust cloud. James cursed in rage and frustration, and started off once more at breakneck speed down the iron staircase.
Sir,
came Burns' urgent shout at his back. He was looking out over the side, pointing back down into the hall.
What in God's name?
Muttered James in disbelief, as he followed Burns' gaze. There was some disturbance around the light source in the centre of the dust storm. Showers of sparks flickered all about, and the very air seemed to shimmer and bend like some bizarre heat haze. And then a dark shadow appeared, hanging in the air, surrounded by a flash of spark and static. Slowly, the form began to push itself out into the hall, but James was unable to make out its identity from so far away.
It looks like a beak,
whispered the terrified technician from behind him. James looked around. He had forgotten the young man was still with them. He went to scoff at the boy's remark, then stopped himself. Indeed, the dark shape, slowly forming out of nothing, looked like some dark, bird-like beak. Only the proportions were immense. The shape continued to push its way out, as if tearing through an invisible barrier. The security teams and technicians stood and stared in amazement. Then the beak opened wide to reveal a hideous row of vicious teeth and a long, lolling tongue. A terrifying howl emanated from its jaws, rising above the sounds of the storm and the thunder of the array. It was a bestial, alien cry, which sent terror convulsing through James's body. He looked down, only to see the personnel fleeing in panic.
Come on!
He yelled to Burns, and charged once more down the stairs, leaving the young technician crouching against the wall, paralysed with fear.
Lydia, no!
Screamed Stuart Nix in panic, as one of his colleagues made a desperate attempt to get to the emergency shut-off controls. He watched helplessly as the wind lifted her off her feet and threw her to the floor. She flung out her arms, but it was no use. She slid across the bare concrete and disappeared into the heart of the storm. Nix shielded his eyes against the light and dust and managed to glimpse the door of the array chamber, still open wide. For a second, he thought he spied the body of the man security had just shot, still lying at the heart of the clouds.
"What the hell's going on?"
screamed one of the security team. They were crouched together in the shelter of a stack of large metal crates.
"I don't have any idea,"
he yelled back, his voice barely audible over the howling wind.
"Shouldn't we be getting the hell out of here?"
shouted the soldier in panic, his eyes screwed up against the dust. Nix didn't reply. He was peering into the dust clouds in confusion. Sparks slid around the storm, and he looked on open-mouthed as a dark shape formed from nowhere, hovering about 15 feet in the air. Slowly the shape seemed to grow, flashes of electricity arcing across its length as it pushed itself out into the world. He caught a glimpse of a tooth, and the red of a tongue, and the sickening realization hit him. On either side of the monstrous shape appeared two great sets of talons. Then the entire head of the impossible beast was visible, and Nix looked into its dark, malevolent eyes. It had a straight beak of black bone, and the head of some terrible, naked bird. Its sagging flesh was mottled and covered in dust, and exuded a choking stench of decay. Rows of fangs glistened in its open maw, and its long tongue lolled hungrily from one side. It flung its head back and howled, the sound alien and terrible. Nix covered his ears in abject fear, looking up in dismay as the creature continued to drag its stinking bulk out from the field.
"I said, shouldn't we get the hell out of here?"
screamed the soldier again, and this time Nix didn't ignore him. The two men sprinted from their hiding place and fled towards the exits as fast as they could, joining the panic of terrified personnel, all of them desperate to get to safety. Spears clung to his mind, trying to calm himself so as not to be swept away on a wave of his own euphoria. He tentatively let his awareness run around the room, and he felt a ferocious surge of exultation as his own power threatened to burst free. Wherever he moved his attention, it was as if his will were transported there. He felt the coldness of the metal of the ship as if it were his skin. He felt the heat of the storm around him tingle on his nerves, and the glorious, terrified energy of his crew aroused a flame in him. He moved his mind forwards, and the massive ship followed his will, slowly lifting and accelerating at the head of his vast army. He turned his attention to his surroundings, and cried out in ecstasy at the surge of information which swamped him. He saw the cliffs far away in the distance, and knew the movements of their vessels as his mind washed over the ship's radar systems and scanners. He looked into the minds of all his personnel on the vessel, and screamed with mirth. He felt their essence. He knew their thoughts. He was the ship and the crew, and he was more. He was a god. He laughed again at his power, heaving his mind to hold himself in check as another wave of energy ran through him. It was all he could do to prevent his powers from being released in a force of destruction, but it was not time yet. He pushed his will beyond the ship, and felt his awareness speed over the red rocks at an incredible velocity. His mind careered between tanks and tracked vehicles, until he spied the Divinity, the ship belonging to that weak-willed slave, Colonel Boynes. With an ecstatic laugh, Spears presented himself to the little man, frightened in his control room. "Surrender yourselves to me," he boomed, and his voice shook the cliffs. He didn't wait for their reply. It was of no consequence. He was a god, and they would all bow to him and serve him no matter what. Besides, he would enjoy using his newfound powers to crush them. Colonel Boynes lolled in his chair, still staring at the monitor screen in dismay.
"Sir, the Herald is hailing us," repeated the officer, waiting anxiously for his orders.
"Put it up on screen," croaked Boynes at last in a hoarse whisper. He suddenly had the feeling that he was completely ill-equipped for this bizarre, surreal world. His mind was unable to bend with each fantastic revelation that assaulted him. The monitor panel flickered and went dark. All eyes in the control room strained to make out the grainy image.
"Oh my God,"
whispered Boynes, as he started to make sense of the scene. He recognized the control room of the Herald, but only just. The entire space was filled with intertwining fronds or tentacles, like some ghastly eruption of vegetation. Boynes felt a wave of nausea hit him as he recognized the shapes of crew, all bound and wrapped tightly by the slimy growths, still sat at their posts, struggling weakly. He traced the tentacles back with his eyes. They all converged at a single point in the center of the room. The camera zoomed in, and Boynes discerned the shape of a naked man, curled fetus-like at the confluence of the writhing mass. It was Spears. His mottled skin had a ghastly sheen of sweat glistening upon it. He lay on a bed of tentacles which appeared to emanate from his abdomen, writhing out and filling the room, binding his crew and the ship to him. His face, locked in a crazed grimace, looked as if it were carved from wax. Only his eyes moved, darting around in his skull as if trying to escape.
"Surrender yourselves to me,"
came a muffled whisper through his clenched jaw, and a trail of spittle fell from his lips with the effort.
"What have you done?"
croaked Boynes to himself, unable to take in the terrible scene he was witnessing. Then, without warning, the monitor screen went blank. "We've lost transmission, sir," called his communications officer.
"Yes, thank you,"
muttered Boynes, still in a state of shock. He glanced over to Major Hawking, whose face bore an expression of horror similar to his own.
"Any news on the status at the entry point? Can we begin the evacuations yet?"
The dread was heavy in his voice, cutting through the oppressive silence of the control room. Major Hawking shook his head wearily.
"We've still received no word from Wandsworth," he said nervously, and his voice dropped to a whisper. "And we think that the creature may have got through. We tried to send a team back, but..."
His voice trailed off in exhaustion and fear. None of them wanted to consider the consequences of where events were leading.
"It still appears that the entry point is somehow in its open state. We may be able to evacuate, but we would leave the doorway open, totally undefended." "Dear God," whispered Boynes to himself under his breath.
He looked around the control room for a moment as if lost, then gave a long sigh, steeling himself for the inevitable battle to come.
"Then we have no choice," he said wearily. "We must be prepared to stay here and defend the entry point. To the last."
He turned to Vladich, who sat impassively beside him. The pale-faced man appraised the colonel with his dark eyes. Boynes recognized a look in them, a reflection of nightmares witnessed, which he realized his own face now mirrored. He felt a wave of newfound respect for this quiet man, who had lived the last 20 years of his life with these unimaginable horrors, and had learned to survive. That was a reassuring thought for Boynes, and the old colonel felt a glimmer of hope. Nick sprinted across the array hall, the wind whipping all around him as the cry of the hideous beast still cut at his back. He jostled with technicians and soldiers, all fleeing towards the exits in panic. As they neared the doorways, a bottleneck occurred as people pushed and fought their way through the chaos. In the melee, Nick lost his footing and tripped, stumbling heavily to the ground. He looked back down towards the array chamber in panic. The monster had almost fully entered the hall now. With a final heave, it dragged at its bulk, causing another flurry of sparks. Nix tried to look away, but he was mesmerized by the sight. The animal stood almost 15 feet tall, and seemed to be some bizarre collection of creatures melded awkwardly together. It had the head and beak of a small bird, but it was featherless, and a bony outcrop over its small, lifeless eyes gave it a prehistoric quality. Two great bat-like wings were folded up against its side, and the creature balanced upon its bony knuckles. A small, spindly body was hung with soft, grey skin. The long train of its ragged flesh wings spread out behind it like some hideous cape. But as Nix watched, the shape of the creature seemed to melt before his eyes, shifting and inconstant. He watched as spines grew from the crest of its protruding backbone, and its beak became slender and elongated. Despite his predicament, Nix watched in fascination as the personnel still streamed past him, fighting for the exits. A small group of 5 soldiers had taken up positions around the creature, and with a deafening retort, they opened fire. Shots ricocheted all around the animal, sparks flying from its bony body as it screamed its fury. A sudden hiss of steam burst from one of the array columns behind the creature, and before he knew what he was doing, Nix found himself up and running back towards the beast, yelling and waving his arms in panic.
"Stop firing!"
he roared, but his words were buried beneath the chaos of the storm and the bellowing of the creature. As he charged, gasping across the vast hall, he saw the animal shift again before his eyes. Its soft, grey skin hardened over to form an insect-like armoured layer, and the small arms fire from the soldiers glanced ineffectually off its sides. With a sudden swift peck of its slender beak, the nearest soldier gave a short grunt and fell to the floor, a huge livid wound through his chest. The soldiers increased their rate of fire in desperation, and shots sprayed all about, hitting machinery and pipes with great sparks. Nix reached the nearest soldier and grabbed the man's shoulder in alarm.
"Stop firing!"
he yelled again, and the hysteria in his voice caused the fearful soldier to look around. The beast was no more than 20 feet away from them, and its cries were deafening. Nix retched upon the hideous stench which emanated from its carcass.
"You can't shoot in here!"
he shouted, as the array soldier looked back blankly.
"If you rupture the coolant tanks, the whole array could blow up!"
He pointed desperately to the cluster of pipes and gas towers all around the chamber. A look of realization passed over the soldier's face, and he barked fearfully into his headset.
"Cease fire! Hold your fire! Fall back! Fall back!"
The three remaining soldiers looked up and turned to make a dash for safety. With a swift movement, the creature hopped forward on its bony knuckles and caught another soldier in its jaws. There was a sickening crunch as its beak snapped shut, and the soldier fell to the floor in two pieces. Nix and the three soldiers backed away, as the creature paused and studied the human remains as if out of curiosity. Its dark, lifeless eyes reminded Stuart of a shark, malevolent and alien. Gases were venting from several pipes punctured by gunfire, but in the chaos Nix couldn't tell whether any critical systems had been damaged.
"What the fuck can we do if we can't shoot it?"
yelled the nearest soldier, as they backed away. Nix gave him a grim shrug of his shoulders.
"If we can keep it in here,"
he yelled,
"then the only way out are the far exits. It looks too big to get through them, but I don't know."
His voice trailed off as the creature looked up suddenly, its eye making contact with his. Nix felt his heart stop for a second, as the force of the creature's will seemed to flow over him. Then, the creature raised its head on its long, prehensile neck, and gave another shrill cry. It stretched its arms out, and its wings seemed to unfold forever, dwarfing its small body. With a sudden gust of wind that knocked the group to the floor, the creature launched itself into the air, in a leap which took it 50 feet at the side of the vast array. It fastened itself to the side of a large cylindrical tower, and immediately began pecking at the metal with its monstrous beak.
"Oh my god," croaked Nix.
The soldiers looked up in confusion.
"The main venting system," he explained with a voice of dread to their blank faces. "If it gets through that maintenance hatch, it will lead into the venting shafts, and from there it can get into the array tunnels." "But then it's trapped, right?"
asked one of the soldiers in panic. Nix looked at him in horror.
"The array is a network of hundreds of tunnels that run in a circle 30 miles in diameter. Once it gets in there, it could get out anywhere. We've got to stop it."
He charged off towards the main exits. The soldiers looked at each other for a second, then charged off after him.
"Thomas, slow down,"
gasped Grace in exhaustion. She stumbled and fell to her knees, her gloved hand sinking into the soft cushion of close-cropped grass.
"Slow down,"
she managed again, looking around at the exquisite perfection before her. The entire rolling plain was carpeted in an endless, beautiful mass of glowing flowers, and Grace felt hot tears in her eyes as she tried to take in the sheer, quiet splendour of the vista. But Thomas was oblivious to her cries, blind to everything but the rust-covered monolith dominating the centre of the plain. Exposed and alone, the angel stood motionless amidst the flowers, delicate fronds and slender shoots entwining its massive armoured legs. And beyond the angel, Thomas could make out a wall of shadow, indistinct and ephemeral, yet acutely ominous. The black tide of the approaching army was sweeping down towards the solitary figure.
"Thomas!"
shouted Grace again, as she wearily pulled herself to her feet, the heavy bulk of her environment suit dragging down her every movement. Sullivan stopped and looked behind. Grace was perhaps 30 yards away. In the distance, if he squinted, Thomas thought he could make out the ephemeral shapes of the three defending forces. their aircraft and tanks blurred and indistinct, as if they hung on the edge of a different reality. The only solid beings in the sun-drenched plain of green and yellow were himself, Grace, and the Angel.
"They've left it unprotected,"
he yelled back to Grace.
"It's fragile. They'll destroy it. Don't they understand? It's trying to help us."
He turned back towards the Angel and staggered on, his exhausted steps barely faster than a walking pace. By the time Grace reached the Angel, even she could make out the approaching army, a dark wall of fear casting an ominous shadow over the bright sun. Thomas was slumped by the side of the huge figure, his hands resting lightly upon the corroded metal of its feet. His head was bowed and he whispered quiet words to himself. Grace stared up at the Angel. It looked lifeless, an empty suit, unmoving and unresponsive to Thomas's pleas for help. Her lungs burned from her efforts, and she felt lightheaded.
"I need a cigarette,"
she gasped quietly to herself, then turned back to the approaching hordes.
"They should have protected it,"
croaked Thomas, looking up at the Angel with tears in his eyes.
"Don't they understand? It's trying to help us. We asked for its help. It won't refuse us."
"Thomas," Grace whispered urgently. He looked up at her, then followed her gaze, staggering wearily to his feet. He stood next to Grace and she glanced tenderly across to him, taking his hand gently in hers.
"I guess we're too late,"
she whispered, as the shadow of the charging army crashed down, engulfing them in its darkness. You have been listening to The Heaven Field. For more information, downloads, and artwork, visit theheavenfield.com.